This week on Pirate Party Radio, Canadian hospitals secretly kept and shared DNA of 800,000 babies. Time Warner refuses to release identities of thousands of copyright infringers. And the Pirate Party of Sweden takes over hosting of the Pirate Bay. This is Pirate Party Radio episode 29 for Thursday, May 20th, 2010.
So I just ask you a couple of things that affect a lot of consumers point blank. If you buy a CD, are you allowed to copy it and put it on your own iPod under your bill?
You're really going to have to wait for the bill. I mean, there are cabinet confidences here.
There are a lot of people that think that the consultation that you guys met many, many, many times with the business side and not really representative consultation with the consumer. And so people feel like the consumer is going to be left out in the cold here.
Anybody who says that is saying that in absence of actually having read the legislation. So people are judging something.
Okay, tell us what's in the legislation.
Okay,
I just want to know because, look, I put a lot of songs on an iPod, and I'm totally fine being a lawbreaker, but that's me, right? That's an indicator.
Well, we did consultations, and they were broad. They included everybody, including the general public. I did town halls in Montreal and Quebec City. We had one in here in Vancouver. We were all over the place. And we heard from a broad cross-section of people. There was no slanting one way or the other. And the general public had given their own feedback as they wished to. And we received thousands of responses and some very good ideas. Copyright legislation was tried under the Liberals under a bill called Bill C-60. We tried under C-61. There have been some private members' bills in the House of Commons. There's plenty of grist for the mill. And all kinds of good ideas came out of the consultation. And I will tell you that the legislation will reflect what we've committed to do in the throne speech, which is a balance and modernization in our copyright regime.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cause. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for the links to all the news stories I mentioned during the show. And the intro clip off the top of the show was Heritage Minister James Moore, Heritage Minister of Canada, James Moore, talking on a television show called The Hour. I'm going to talk about that a little later on in the show today. And I've got an incoming message. Mikhail, 79, from Finland, says, I got an idea that the pirate movement should have their own Linux distribution. So I created Pirate Buntu Project in build.reconstructor.org. My personal Linux know-how isn't that good that I could make it good, but if there is people how are interested to develop this project forward, they could send me an email to Mikhail, M-I-K-A-E-L, 19790@gmail.com. And I think that's a great idea to have an Ubuntu or any kind of Linux distribution that has privacy in mind, that keeps in tune with the Pirate Party kind of ethics in terms of privacy and free speech and in terms of copyright and all of the things that encompass the Pirate Party ethics. So that's a great idea, and good luck with that. Maybe somebody will want to help you out with that, or maybe there's already one out there existing that falls in line with all the things that you're looking for. So if one is already created, why recreate the wheel? But so good luck with that. Hopefully somebody will help you out. If you'd like to contact me, ask a question, or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form, and it goes straight to me. In pirate news off the top of the show, it looks like one of the stories last week wasn't really a story, so I want to retract it. Secret telecom anti-net neutrality plan isn't. It was that kind of leaked demonstration of what their plans were to attack net neutrality, and it wasn't really something that was real. I'll read it out. The Center for American Progress seems to have blockbuster news on Tuesday, an exposed title, Telecom Secret Plan to Attack Net Neutrality. On its Think Progress blog, the liberal advocacy group announced it obtained a PowerPoint document which revealed how the telecom industry is orchestrating the latest campaign against net neutrality through a pseudo-grassroots effort. The story was echoed on Slashdot, Boing Boing, and innumerable pro-regulation blogs. There's just one problem with Think Progress's claim. It's not, well, accurate. In the case of truth being stranger than AstroTurf, it turns out that the PowerPoint document was prepared as a class project for a competition in Florida last month. It cost the six students a grand total of $173.95, including $18 for clip art. The No Net New Brutality campaign idea was one of the four finalists created as an assignment for a 2.5-week think tank MBA program. The other finalists were a project promoting free speech in Venezuela, one supporting education reform in Poland, and one dealing with sales tax rates in Washington, D.C. The No Net Brutality came in third, and the Polish reform idea won. So, led astray by news reports that really weren't true. But I like to follow them up and tell you if there was any incorrect factual news that I reported on the show, because I don't want to lead you astray as well. And it's very good to check out all these stories by yourself as well to see if they are a little bit slanted or if they're not showing you the whole truth. Do not take my word for it. Please check out these stories. That's why I post the links, so you can look them up yourself and look for other opposing points of view, because even if everything I say is the truth, omitting some facts change the story. So if things aren't said, that does alter the way the story is presented. Doesn't mean what I'm saying is not true. It just means the whole picture is not there. Some copyright news from Canada. Rogers, we're concerned with the Acton negotiations and three strikes. And now Rogers is a media corporation, a media company that deals with cell phones, television, other forms of an ISP, other forms of data communications in Canada, if you don't know what Rogers is for everybody else outside of Canada. This is off Michael Geist's blog, Send It Behind Grindr. Rogers Communication appeared before the Standing Committee on Canadian Heritage and was asked by NDP MP Charlie Angus about the position on ACTA and ISP liability. Ken Engelhardt, Senior VP Regulatory, left little doubt about the company's concerns with ACTA and the possibility of a three strikes and you're out model coming to Canada. He says, we are concerned, as many ISPs are, about the ACTA negotiations. It's supposed to be about counterfeiting, but it seems to have gone way past counterfeiting to talk about issues of ISPs and the downloading activities of our customers. We don't think ISPs should be put in the position of being traffic cops to decide what is legal and what is not. We really hate any idea that we would have to terminate our customer service on a three strikes policy. We do not want to do that at all. I have a great deal of sympathy for the copyright holders who feel that the content is being stolen. It's a big problem, but I don't want to see this being done by putting ISPs in the position of having to disconnect their customers or to aid in the conviction of their customers. When asked to expand on how ISPs and copyright holders strike the balance, Engelhardt focused on the effectiveness of the current notice and notice system, arguing that those type of mechanisms should be exhausted before any more draconian measures are imposed. Because currently in Canada, it's the copyright holders send a message to the ISPs and of what movie or what piece of music, and then the ISPs forwarded on without any information, personal information being forwarded back to the copyright holders. Next one's copyright news from the U.S. Obama's DOJ pick, RIA lawyer who killed Grokster. This is sent in by Weird Wolf. And the last story was sent in by Hindgrinder, if I didn't mention that. Weird Wolf says, seems the Obama administration is going to appoint one of the entertainment prosecutors that went after Grokster, did BSA's bidding, and on and on. He's being appointed to the U.S. Department of Justice Solicitor General. I may have things in my past that made my jaw drop under the Bush administration, but more and more I'm starting to get scared about this one. The story says, President Obama is continuing to fill the senior ranks of the U.S. Department of Justice with copyright industry's favorite lawyers. Donald Verrilli announced Wednesday that he had been named Associate Deputy Attorney General. Verrilli is the lawyer who pulled the plug on Grokster, sued Google on behalf of Viacom, and represented the RIAA against a Minnesota woman named Jamie Thomas, who's accused of illicit file sharing, who had to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars. This follows a string of other pro-copyright industry picks that Obama has made. Last month, there was Obama's selection. Last month, there was Obama's selection of a top RIA lawyer currently scoring off in court with Harvard University's Berkman Center to be third in command of the Justice Department. Vice President Joe Biden has long been an ally of the recording industry, urging the criminal prosecutions of copyright infringing peer-to-peer users and trying to create a new federal felony involving playing unauthorized music. And another senior Justice Department post has gone to top anti-piracy enforcement for the BSA, a strong supporter of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act's anti-circumvention rules. Obama's latest choice, Verrilli, is a senior litigator in the Washington, D.C. offices of the Jenner and Block law firm. In technology circles, he's probably best known for arguing the Minnesota case called Capital versus Thomas. In that case, the RIA convinced the judge to accept jury instructions saying that the making copyrighted sound recordings available for electronic distribution on a peer-to-peer network violated the law, even if none had actually been transferred. Verrilli won the first round with a federal jury saying October 2007 that Thomas had to pay $220,000. But then the judge threw out the verdict, concluding the jury instructions he approved were misleading. The RIA is hoping to hold on to the initial verdict and is currently appealing. One reason why this case is especially relevant to Verrilli's new job is that the Justice Department intervened in the Thomas case on behalf of the RIAA. That has already caused some tech lobbyists to wonder privately about whether or not Verrilli will recuse himself from matters that affect their former clients. Another example of relevant case involves the Supreme Court asking the Justice Department for input on the case involving Cablevision, another lawsuit that Verrilli was part on behalf of copyright holders. Disclosure, the film studios and television networks that brought the suit against Cablevision include Time Warner, News Corp, Walt Disney, and CBS, which owns CBS Interactive, publisher of CNET News, where this came from, I guess. A Jenner and Block press release that says that Verrilli led the Jenner and Block team that is pursuing a $1 billion copyright case on behalf of Viacom against Google and YouTube, alleging massive violations of Viacom's copyrighted motion pictures and television shows. So this looks to be shaping up to be a very big conflict of interest, appointing him to head off the department where he used to have to interact with. So he's going to be kind of in bed with the people that he used to work with and be able to sway some power to their side. But of course, this would happen in any kind of appointment, that you would be the expert in the department that you'd be appointed for, or have major involvement and have some history with that. So we're going to have to keep a very close eye on the interactions that are going to take place. And it looks like Obama's filling his cabinet with people that are against loosening the controls of copyright that have gone way too far for too long. Some more copyright news from the U.S. Music piracy unstoppable, Universal admits, sent in by Weandy. An executive from the world's largest music company has admitted that global piracy cannot be stopped. So he stopped living in a dream world and has come woken up to reality. Francis Keeling, the vice president of digital at Universal Music Group International, said, "Are you going to stop piracy? No, you're not. To try and set that as an objective is just not going to succeed. Can we make piracy socially unacceptable? Absolutely. And that has been our ambition around the world. Universal's artists include Lady Gaga and Rihanna. Speaking at the Great Escape Music Convention in Brighton, Mr. Keeling said, "We've got markets like Spain and Italy where people say, 'You buy music? What are you doing buying music when you can get it for free?'" Clearly, those markets are in the situation where unless we can turn those markets around, we're going to have a major problem having a music business there. Universal has been prominent in the fight against illegal file sharing. It has thrown its full weight behind the UK's Digital Economy Act, which will bring in sanctions against serial offenders, including the possibility of temporary internet suspensions. The controversial law was approved last month, and Mr. Keeling stressed it was the right solution. He also said he was confident that the new Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition government would remain supportive of the bill. The deal of the sanctions and how they will be imposed have to be worked out. The solution needs to be fair, proportionate, and implemented well, Mr. Keeling told delegates. Well, I had a discussion recently related to this about, you know, copyright and how it's impossible to stop. And I used the analogy of replicators. Like they had on Star Trek, where you just punch in what you want or say what you want, and it would spit it out, designed exactly perfectly. You want a hot Earl Grey tea, it would spit out a hot Earl Grey tea made from some magic box. Now, if there was a way for the general public to replicate all physical objects with little or no cost or effort, would there be an outcry for them to be banned? Say you could replicate a cell phone or an iPod or any kind of material you would like with no cost at all. Would innovation of all things cease? Would people stop making things just because you could replicate things forever? But just like the monks who used to hand copy books before the printing press and the whip and buggy manufacturers before cars emerged, there was outrage at new inventions that were destroying their livelihoods. So, because the livelihoods of the middlemen of the music business and the movie business are supposedly being ruined, is it going to take down art itself? Are people going to stop playing music, stop making movies, because the model that they've held up for the last 50 or 75 years is broken down? No, they're going to have to adapt and change. So the monks that used to hand copy books out by scrawling them, would maybe you could transition to the printing press business. Or the whip and buggy manufacturers can transfer over to making parts for cars. Things like that. You have to roll with the times. You have to innovate. You can't rest on your laurels and expect to be paid exactly as you've been paid before for exactly what you've been making forever and ever. You can't legislate your way into being outmoded. You have to go with the times. And following that up, they've wasted no time with rolling out the propaganda that they've promised in that last story, with making piracy socially unacceptable. Listen to this next story. Worldwide copyright news. Axis of P2P evil. Congress and RIAA call out the six worst websites in the world. This morning, the Congressional International Anti-Piracy Caucus held a press conference along with RIAA CEO Mitch Bainwall to call out the six worst websites in the world. Think of them as an axis of P2P evil. Who made the cut? Pirate Bay, naturally. Canada's ISO hunt was no surprise. One-click download service RapidShare was less expected, as a German court ruled only 2 weeks ago that the site was not responsible for infringement by its users and that it had no duty to preemptively censor uploaded content. More surprising were the last three sites. Ukraine's MP3 Fiesta, which operates like the now-shuttered AllOfMP3.com, Luxembourg's Remix4U.com, RMX4U.com, which bills itself as the biggest community for black music in the world, and Baidu, the Chinese search engine, so popular Google couldn't even make a dent in its ratings. The IAPC is a bipartisan group of 11 senators and a huge number of representatives, and they are concerned that America's copyright industries are suffering at the hand of lax or non-existent enforcement by many foreign governments. That's why they wrote in a recent recent letter, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement is so important. But look at the list of websites and services for the moment. What's missing? Grokster, Demonoid, Oink, all of MP3, LimeWire, Napster, Newsbin, and Mininova. That's because the copyright industries have in fact been remarkably successful in court within the existing legal framework of both the USA and foreign countries over the last few years. Newsbin announced its own closure this week after a long legal fight, while LimeWire lost in a US federal court last week. Even the Pirate Bay's ISP had to stop hosting the site this week, and a Swedish court has already ruled against the Pirate Bay's administrators. Still, even with such tremendous victories behind it, the RIAA can't resist a spot of over-the-top rhetoric. So here it comes. Here comes the propaganda that's going to be unleashed upon the world. So listen for these words and phrases. The global challenge in the years to come will be to win the battle for a civilized internet that respects property, privacy, and security, said Bainwall. An internet of chaos may meet a utopian vision, but surely undermines the societal values of safe and secure families and job and revenue-creating commerce. Shining the spotlight on these websites sends a vital message to users, advertisers, payment processors, and governments around the world. Yes, that's right. A Ukrainian website called MP3 Fiesta is threatening the safety and security of your family, and a good chunk of Congress wants to do something about it. So watch for posters of propaganda being put up in your neighborhoods touting the evils that sharing music has upon your family and friends. Copyright news from the U.S. RIAA wins big in LimeWire lawsuit. This is referencing the last story about what happened with LimeWire, sent in by Wiondi. In a decision that can mean sweeping changes to file sharing in the United States, a federal court has found the company that operates file sharing service LimeWire liable for copyright infringement, according to court records reviewed by CNET. U.S. District Judge Kimba Wood from the Southern District of New York on Tuesday granted summary judgment in favor of the music industry's claims that Lime Group, parent of LimeWire software maker LimeWire, the founder, Mark Gorton, committed copyright infringement, engaging in unfair competition and induced copyright infringement. The evidence demonstrates that LimeWire optimized LimeWire's features to ensure that users can download digital recordings, the majority of which are protected by copyright, Wood said in her 59-page decision, and that LimeWire assisted users in committing infringement. The court decision could represent the biggest threat to online file sharing in years. According to a survey by the NPD Group, LimeWire users account for 58% of the people who said they download music from a peer-to-peer service last year. That's hard to believe, actually. I haven't heard the name LimeWire pop up in about half a decade, so that really threw me off. At CNETsDownload.com, the LimeWire software has been downloaded more than 200 million times. In the last week alone, the software was downloaded nearly 340,000 times. Wood's ruling could, at the very least, mean a shift in the downloading habits of millions. The logical next step by the RIAA, the trade group representing the four largest recording companies, is to get a preliminary injunction to force LimeWire to cease LimeWire's it's very funny. It says LimeWire is LimeWire, but one's a company and one's the software. LimeWire's file sharing functionality. Well, good luck with that. There's about 150,000 other programs and methods to do what you just achieved. You're able to, you know, push one thing underground and 1,000 more pop up. And of course, DHT and Magnetic Links make all of this a moot argument, as there's no need for torrent files or website indexing, or LimeWire itself. Google will be able to provide all the indexing you need as it crawls around the web, picking up information about all the magnetic links available. So your next target really is Google, and we'll see whose pockets are deeper as you try and suppress information and indexing of information itself. It's impossible. You cannot do it. So why are you spending all this money and wasted effort when you could be redirecting it towards innovation so you can survive in this new world of data sharing? You have to be innovative. Taking things to court is just wasting your money and wasting your time. How long have you fought this? When was Napster? That was over 10 years ago. Have you quashed file sharing? Have you made a dent in file sharing? Not one iota. You're wasting your time and money. You need to concentrate on giving the public what they want so you can compete with the file sharing sites. Make a complete index of your whole back catalog, offered at a reasonable price, fully documented, pictures. All the ID3 has been filled in with all the information about the artist. Easy navigation, easy search. People will flock to your site if it is better than what is being offered for free out there. People like convenience. That's what they want. They want to be able to get what they want quickly and for a reasonable cost. Right now, you're not being able to compete with what's out there. You have to be, you're the people who own this music. You should be on the cutting edge, not people offering it for free out there. You as a content owner need to listen to what's happening out there and not taking people to court one by one or companies to court one by one. It is not deterring anyone or spreading propaganda through the world. It's just dragging your name through the mud. And at one point, people will just say, forget it. We're not downloading music even from you. We're not buying music from you. There's enough independent artists who have innovated and caught on to the new methods of distribution of data through the web, and we know how to get their music without any trouble, without any cost, without any legal problems. And you're going to be left in the dust, scratching your head, wondering who is left to take to court, because there won't be anybody left to take to court, because they're now ignoring you, because there's a new breed of artists out there that don't even go through you. They won't be covered by you. They won't be represented by the MPAA and RIAA. They'll be independent artists selling their music directly from their website to the end user, making direct one-on-one contact through all the social media sites and be able to update their users without having to go through the wall of corporations that are repressing the music that is coming out right now. Copyright news from Australia. Most pirates said they pay for legal downloads. Sent in by Platon. Now here's an example of how it should be. Most people who illegally download music, movies, and TV shows would pay for them if it was a cheap and legal service as convenient as file-sharing tools like BitTorrent. That's the finding of the most comprehensive look yet at people who illegally download TV shows, music, and movies in Australia conducted by news.com.au and market research firm Core Data. The survey canvassed the attitudes of more than 7,000 people who admitted to streaming or downloading media from illegitimate sources in the past 12 months. It found accessibility was as much or more of a motivator than money for those who illegally downloaded media using services like BitTorrent. More respondents said they turned to illegal downloads because they were convenient, than because they were free. When it came to all three types of media covered by the survey, TV shows, movies, and music, and more than two-thirds said they would pay for downloads from a legitimate service that was just as convenient if it existed. The hypothetical legitimate service was described as giving users access to TV shows, movies, and music they wanted when they wanted, without ads or copy protection. And now there are the keys. The music industry says we provide it. We give it through all these different means, but yet it's burdened with DRM. You can't transfer it from one computer to the other. They want you to purchase it five times for your house, your car, your computer, your iPod, and your phone. No, that's not the way it's going to work. And until you realize that, you're going to continue to lose money to the alternate sources. I'll continue on. TV shows are illegally downloaded more regular and by more people than movies or music. Gen Y is prepared to pay more for legal downloads of TV shows and movies than any other age group, while people between 31 and 50 are more likely to pay top dollar for music. The most popular prices for legal downloads chosen by respondents were $1 per TV show, $2 per movie, and 50 cents per music track. David Crafty, the president of the Pirate Party Australia political group, said the survey results showed illegal downloaders were in fact frustrated customers. People aren't just looking for a free ride. They're living in the modern world and expecting business models to keep up with them, he said. Mr. Crafty said restrictive copy protection measures that crippled many legal download stores, such as locking movie or music files so that they can only be played on specific devices, turn users off buying media through legitimate channels. And that is the key there. I have seen many, many music stores locking down the music to specific players, or they have to phone home to authenticate the music, and then they get shut down in 1 or 2 years because their business model doesn't work. And what are you left with? A bunch of data and a bunch of files that can't be played because the server for authentication has gone down. You don't own them. You can't transfer them from one device to another. They are useless, and you're out all that money. You have to buy it again. And what is that going to be leaving you with? A bad taste in your mouth, and you're going to be heading off to some other location to get it from a place that you don't have to worry about DRM and transferring one place to the other. He continues on. Mr. Crafty said restrictive copyright measures that crippled... Well, I think what it comes down to is freedom. They just want you to know that they've got the data. They can watch it whenever they want on whatever device they want, and they can watch it for 3 months or later, a year later, and not have any time limitations. If there was a legitimate online service that gave people the same freedoms offered by pirated media at a cheap price, Mr. Crafty said, many downloaders would switch to it. They'd be happy to sign up for it, to not be able to have to search BitTorrent, have to figure out which bad quality version of it to get, he said. While some people would still not pay for it, there'd be enough people who would pay for it to create and maintain a very sustainable media industry. They didn't learn from cassette tapes, and they're still not learning from MP3s online being shared from peer to peer. They're still saying, you're stealing from us, rather than embracing it and putting restrictive copy measures upon their data, which makes people turn off from them. People don't want to carry around CDs anymore. They're big, they're bulky. People are downloading thousands of music albums. They're not buying 1 or 2 CDs a month. They're downloading tons of it. There's so much potential out there. People want this music. And imagine if you drop the price to 50 cents an album, or like $3 an album or something, rather than $10 for the digital album that you have to pay for, which is comparable to the price in the store, and you drop the price and people bought 10 times as much as they would in the store. Imagine how much money you would make, but they don't listen. They don't weigh out the economics of it. And it continues on and on, and it gets to this point. The average cost of a Hollywood movie in 2008 to make and market was $108 million. So it's very... This is Mr. Gain, who is from... I want to get who's saying this. Neil Gain, the executive director of anti-piracy group Australian Federation Against Copyright Theft. And he says, the average cost of a Hollywood movie in 2008, to make and market was $108 million. So it's a very expensive business, and it's a very risky business. To expect to purchase a copy of that movie for $2 is a rather unrealistic ask, said Mr. Gain. Well, maybe movies shouldn't cost that much. Maybe you've got to scale the economy down where it does make sense. Or maybe he's just expecting people, not as many people, to buy it as there would be for $2. $2 a movie? That's nothing. People would pay that in droves for a movie. People still go to the theaters and watch movies. Movies are making more money than ever. It keeps coming out in the news how much money movies are making. Avatar, $3 billion. There it is. People are still going to movies. They're paying the top dollar for the movies they want to see. It's a scale of economies. You just have to figure out that more people would buy movies at a reasonable price for a data movie rather than something that they have to pop in a Blu-ray player that phones back home to make sure you have the correct up-to-date codes to play it, or you're not going to be able to watch the media that you've purchased because, you know, you're a pirate and you have to sit through these 10 minutes of commercials telling you you're a pirate, even though you've bought the DVD, bought the Blu-ray, And, you know, the pirated copy doesn't have these warnings. So, you know, they really only warn the people that are their customers. But I've gone off about that before. Copyright news from the U.S. Time Warner Cable tries to put brakes on massive piracy case. This is quite a turnaround. Presented by Mind Inversion, Time Warner Cable has no intention of complying with thousands of requests asking it to identify copyright infringer. Now, keep in mind, Time Warner Cable, Warner, makes movies and music, and they own a lot of media. So for them to say, we're not going to do this, I'll continue on. Remember the U.S. copyright group. They're the D.C. legal outfit that is turning P2P copyright infringers into cash. Partnering with independent movie studios, the big players are not involved to sue individual file swappers in federal court, and the ISPs are not pleased with the plan. Yesterday, Time Warner Cable told a federal court overseeing a massive 2,094-person lawsuit targeting the poor folks who downloaded and, what's worse, apparently watched U-Bowl's Far Cry that the U.S. copyright group's subpoenas were out of control. Copyright cases involving third-party discovery of internet service providers have typically related to a plaintiff's effort to identify anonymous defendants whose numbers rank in the single or low double digits, wrote the cable company. By contrast, plaintiff in this case alone seeks identifying information about 2,049 anonymous defendants and seeks identifying information about 809 internet protocol addresses from TWC, Time Warner Cable. Time Warner Cable does not have enough employees to respond to these requests. In a typical month, the company receives an average of 567 IP lookup requests, nearly all of them coming from law enforcement. These lookup requests involve everything from suicide threats to child abduction to terrorist activity, and the company says that such cases take immediate priority. Let's see. I'll skip down. If the court compels TWC to answer all of these lookup requests, given its current staffing, it would take TWC nearly 3 months of full-time work by the TWC's subpoena compliance group, and TWC would not be able to respond to any other request, emergency or otherwise, from law enforcement during this period. TWC has a six-month retention period for its IP lookup logs, and by the time TWC could turn to law enforcement requests, many of these requests could not be answered. So their current tactics is to have people are downloading these movies and music, and then later on the companies who have the copyright holders of this music and movie get the ISPs to turn over their records and then sue them in court. Why are they going to all this expense and all this trouble paying the lawyers? Why aren't they setting up their own places where they can sell these movies for reasonable prices with no DRM? People will flock to them, have your whole back catalog ready and willing to be downloaded for reasonable prices, and you can skip all the middlemen and the lawyers. Get your customers back. Stop messing around in the courts. Stop trying to keep it the way it is. Time moves on. And you've got to, too. Copyright news from Australia. Aussie rights holders make sweating to the oldies more expensive. Sent in by Mind Inversion. Here's another way they're trying to get all the money they can. According to Australia's Copyright Tribunal, fitness classes have not been paying enough money for the music they play while attendees sweat into their leotards. To fix the problem, the tribunal yesterday announced a new rate for fitness center music, and it's 1,500% higher than the previous rate. Sounds big. It's just 15 times. But still, it could have been much more worse for gyms. Rights holders wanted a 4,000% increase. But many fitness centers already pledged not to pay. They'd rather play bad cover versions than cough up the cash for the original recordings. Currently, fitness clubs in Australia paid 96 cents per class to artists and recording companies for the music they play in workout classes. That amount will now increase to either $15 Australian per class or $1 Australian per attendee. According to Trade Group Fitness Australia, this will increase music costs for an average 1,500-member club from $1,510 a year to $23,400 a year, though the original amount was arguably a ridiculously good deal, given how crucial music is to cut such classes. $1,500 a year, not too bad. This was exactly the argument the Phonographic Performance Company of Australia, PPCA, made to the Copyright Tribunal while lobbying for a higher rate, and it presented plenty of research to prove it. One study examined by the tribunal looked into alternatives to recorded music and concluded that the only viable options were no music at all or the use of beat machines. The popularity of beat machines is then summed up. Even limited use of it would cause considerable migration from fitness classes. Given the importance of music to fitness classes, rights holders wanted more cash. Lots more. Their initial proposal was a rate of $4.54 per member of a fitness center per month, or 99 cents per visit by a casual attendee at such a center. The fee was not related to participation in fitness classes. They say, get that. $4.54 for every club member every month, whether or not that person ever is enrolled in a class. The PPCA would also settle for $20 Australian per fitness class, or very grudgingly, for $1.50 per person per class. So, the audacity of the music industry is getting out of hand. There's no other industry that asserts itself to ongoing royalties like they do. Imagine if the architects of that, the building they used to exercise, demanded $5 a month for every person that used the building. Or the person who paved the parking lot for the gym demanded $1 a day for each car that parked there. I don't understand where the sense of entitlement from musicians and the music industry comes from. There's such a disconnect from every other profession. There's no other profession out there that does this exact thing. Just the entertainment industry has this sort of self-entitlement of ongoing monetary need. Forever and ever, past the year of death, for 70 or 90 years or 50 years, depending on which country you're in. So if you know the answer to this puzzling question, why artists seem to be entitled to all this money forever and ever, when anybody glances at a movie or listens to a music passing by in a store, please email me if you know. Explain how playing a guitar or singing into a microphone gives the right to demand money every time somebody uses your product for the rest of eternity. I don't understand. You played your music. You got paid for it. Move on to your next album. You have to work like everyone else does. You can't make an album and expect everyone to pay you for the rest of eternity. Because you're such an awesome musician, because you're such a special person that you have to be hoisted on high above everyone else. Your time is over. That time has passed. You'll have to know how to leverage your popularity and your abilities to make money with your music in different ways, rather than the legal enforcement that has been going on recently. Privacy news from the U.S. How your web browser rats you out online. Now, this is kind of a follow-up from many months ago. I'll get into it. This is sent by Mind Inversion. You're concerned about your online privacy, and you do all the right things to keep them from being tracked around the web. You purge your cookies regularly, clean out your flash super cookies, even switch your browsers like Browzar, which lets you search and surf the web without leaving traces on your computer. Doesn't matter. Your browser is giving you away. Browsers can offer a window into a computer. The browser's user agent string is visible to websites. For instance, so are HTTP accept headers, and it's simple to infer whether cookies are being blocked. In browsers with JavaScript running, it's easy for websites to discover screen resolution, a list of all browser plugins, and the user's time zone. Throw in Flash, and it's possible to grab a complete list of system fonts. Taken together, these bits of data produce a unique fingerprint that works even in the absence of cookies or traditional web tracking tools. The EFF, concerned about the issue, has just wrapped up its own study of browser fingerprinting, and it finds that even the privacy conscious have made themselves simple to track. Of the 470,000 browsers that participated in the EFF's PanopticLick project, 83.6% had an instantaneous unique fingerprint. Browsers with Flash or Java install could be uniquely identified 94.2% of the time. When one considers that privacy-conscious users were overrepresented in Panopticlick, these are surprising numbers. Even the attempt to go stealthy could paradoxically make one more unique, and thus easier to track. According to the EFF paper, many kinds of measures designed to make a device harder to fingerprint are themselves distinctive, unless a lot of other people are also take them. Thus, the 7 browser users in the survey pools were all easy to pick out. For systems that rely on tracking cookies, fingerprints can be used to bake new cookies for users who have deleted theirs, making cookie trackers much harder to eliminate. And the EFF found that making tweaks to one's browser in the hope of altering fingerprints was largely futile. Algorithms could correctly decipher most fingerprint changes over time. So when I participated in the Panopticlick back when it first came out, and I was completely startled how identifiable I was. I was like close to 1 in 1. I was uniquely identifiable, and I instantly installed NoScript, and that number went way, way down, and I was amongst thousands of other people that identified exactly the same. So you really should read about this. Because even though you're not identifying yourself, you're still being identified, and you should take this test, and it suggests what you can do to de-identify yourself. Say you visit a website, and even if you don't put in your credentials on that website, they've identified you by the marks you leave by your browser identifying itself in these different ways that I've just outlined. Now, one site alone, that's not going to do anything. It's when you visit multiple other sites that all in the background are cooperating with each other and passing this data back and forth. It just takes one website that is participating in this background data sharing to be revealed to every other website. So you go to Facebook, and Facebook is sharing, not surprising, Facebook is sharing with all these other sites through some of their JavaScripts or whatever method they're using to identify you with, and Facebook knows everything about you. So all of a sudden, all these other sites know about you and can identify you easily. And now there's a whole set of people that know who you are, and that can be used against you if you all of a sudden start visiting sites that may be undesirable for other people to find out about you, say the government or your job or your people that you regularly talk with, that maybe you don't want everybody in the world to find out about. Maybe there's some things that you'd like to keep a little private. Maybe there's something that is being repressed in your country, something religious, or something about your sexuality, or something that is socially acceptable in most of the world, but is completely repressed in your area of the world, and you could be threatened because of it. Not because it's illegal, because it's morally reprehensible by a certain group in your country. It's very important stuff. Privacy, people pass it off as not being important because it doesn't relate to them. Maybe it doesn't relate to them, but it does relate to people that they know. And it's very important that you educate everybody around you about how important privacy is, because the loss of privacy could be the loss of life or the loss of your livelihood at the very least. And this next story outlines that very well. Free speech news from Pakistan. I got sent this so many times, I had to go over it. Sent in by Random Hero. This was the after they blocked YouTube. Pakistan blocks YouTube and Facebook. First they blocked Facebook, and then they moved on to YouTube. The Pakistani government has blocked access to YouTube because of what it considers sacrilegious content on the video sharing website. The Pakistan Telecommunications Authority did not point to specific material on YouTube that prompted it to block its site on Thursday. citing only growing sacrilegious contents. It's the second time in 2 days that the government has restricted access to the internet sites it deems offensive to the country's majority Muslim population. On Wednesday, it blocked access to Facebook because of a page that invited users to submit drawings of Prophet Muhammad, which is a violation of Islam. In both cases, the government took action after it failed to persuade the websites to remove the derogatory material, the regulation body said in a statement. It welcomed representatives from two websites to contact the Pakistani government to resolve the dispute in a way that encourages religious harmony and respect. The regulatory body said it blocked more than 450 internet links containing offensive material, but it's unclear of how many of the links were blocked in the last 2 days. Access to the online encyclopedia Wikipedia and the photo sharing site Flickr was also restricted Thursday. YouTube attracts just over 2 billion views every day from users in more than 200 countries, the Google-owned company announced Monday. The government blocked Facebook on Wednesday after a group of Islamic lawyers won a court order requiring officials to restrict access to the site until May 31st. Facebook said Wednesday was investigating the controversial page. While the content does not violate our terms, we do understand it may not be legal in some countries, the company said in a statement. In cases like this, the approach is sometimes to restrict certain content from being shown in specific countries. It remains to be seen how successful the government will be at keeping Pakistan's nearly 20 million internet users from accessing the blocked sites. In other countries such as China, permanently ban Facebook and YouTube, but citizens often have little trouble working their way around the ban using proxy servers and other means. What's common to Facebook and Lashkar-e-Taiba? One user said on Twitter, wrote referring to a Pakistani militant group. They're both banned in Pakistan, but Pakistani can still find them if they want to. So there's an example of why privacy is important if you are living in one of those countries that is being repressed for things that you're saying or sites that you're visiting or things that you're posting. If you were in that country and you were found out to being posting something like that, then you could be jailed or killed or something along those lines. And what is moral and right in one country is not moral and right in another country, or legal rather than right. So it is very important, privacy. That is very important. Patent news from Germany. Germany High Court declares all software potentially patentable. Sent in by Mind Inversion. In a nutshell, after a landmark court ruling, the German perspective on the validity of software patents is now closer than ever that of the U.S. Basically, Germany now has its own Bilski case, with the worst possible outcome for the opponents of software patents. Recently, the enlarged Board of Appeal of the European Patent Office upheld that approach to software patents as well, effectively accepting that a computer program stored on a medium must be patentable in principle. Defense strategies such as the defense of patent license are needed now more than ever. Last month I reported on a ruling by a Federal Court of Justice of Germany that upheld one of Microsoft's FAT patents. I thought that the publication of the detailed decision would provide answers as to whether the largest EU member state has now effectively declared software patentable without any meaningful limits. Today, it turned out that it has indeed happened, but in a different case. In a ruling of April 22nd, whose details now have been published, the highest German appeals court in matters of civil criminal law overturned the country's highest patent specialized court and decided that a client server software for the automated generation of structured documents such as XML or HTML is an example of patented software invention. The case is remanded to this federal patent court, which will now have to uphold the patent unless there's some reason for its invalidity, such as prior art, is found. The ruling has very general implications and ramifications. It's not just about that one case. The decision has effect that in Germany, a country in which software patents were previously only considered valid under relatively strict criteria, all software ideas are now potentially patentable, as long as they are innovative from a purely formal point of view, meaning that they're at least marginally different from how a technical problem was solved before. There are many such patents that the European Patent Office and National Patents Office have granted. Those are now more enforceable than ever. says, here in Europe, the distinction exists theoretically, but it doesn't work practically because it depends on how the patent application are drafted. If I file a straightforward business method patent application in Europe, such as a patent on a method to calculate shipping costs in an electronic commerce, it will usually be rejected. But once I find any technical progress in the implementation, even if it's as insignificant as reducing the size of a data packet containing an order by a few bytes, a negligible cost in terms of bandwidth and storage capacity, especially compared to the likely value of each order, then I might get a software patent and monopolize the same concept just by looking at the same thing from an angle for a patented purpose. Even Amazon's famous one-click patent could be described as a signal processing invention. So what this is saying is that it's going to really put a stranglehold on software innovation, because either everybody's going to be out there patenting every single line of code that they make in their programs, and there's going to be this huge database of code that's patented. And then on the other hand, people are not going to be able to innovate anymore because they're going to have to search through this huge database of code and either pay the companies that hold these lines of code hostage, or come up with completely unique code that does the exact same thing but just changes it just slightly so they don't step on other people's toes. And even if they do that, there's going to be tie-ups in court, and it's going to bring software innovation in Germany to a grinding halt, and it's just going to put ahead other countries that don't have the software patent restrictions ahead of them. They're going to be zooming ahead. They'd have no restrictions placed upon them in terms of how they can develop their software. And it's an overreaching thing that does more harm than good in terms of patenting ideas in terms of software. And it's going to just put a lock upon innovation in the software development area. Privacy news from Canada. Storing BC's baby's blood violates privacy, says group. The BC is sent by Nephilim. The BC Civil Liberties Association says as many as 800,000 babies in the province have been the victims of privacy violations that began the day they were born. A functioning DNA database has been created of all the infants born, EBC told CBC News on Wednesday morning. The association says blood samples taken from infants at birth in BC hospitals are used to test for about 50 genetic disorders. But after those tests are completed, the samples are then kept in storage indefinitely by the hospital system, and some have been used for medical research. According to a statement released by the Newborn Screening Program of BC, the samples, which are kept on a so-called blood spot cards dating back to 1999, have been kept in storage by a private contractor, with no written policy specifying how long they will be kept. Some of the samples have been used by medical research to establish normal values and ranges in order to confirm the accuracy of genetic testing, according to program's director, Hilary Valence, a clinical professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the University of British Columbia. The samples are released to researchers only after the infants' names and identifying details have been removed, and the researches have been approved by UBC Clinical Research Ethics Board, the statement said. The samples can also be useful if a child needs to be retested or if he or she develops a disease later in life, said Valence. But BCCLA Executive Director David Eby says the practice is a breach of privacy because the parents are never informed about the researchers' use of the samples or asked for their consent. One family, which has been chosen to remain anonymous, was particularly concerned about the privacy breach, said Eby. This family is concerned about the fact that their children's information has been stored in this way, that there's no disclosure of the fact that it's been stored like that, and the fact that the cards are available to law enforcement. They're available to government, said EB. And finally, that the cards are actually tested on by researchers out of UBC, all of which is done without the consent of parents. The family's requested the program return their children's blood spot cards and tell them in which research studies they might have been used. EB says the samples should be destroyed if the parents have not given permission for them to be stored. Valence said no government agencies, department, or law enforcement agencies have ever requested the access to the samples. So, they haven't done it in the past, but they could in the future. But they could be released without parents' or donors' consent by a court order. The practice has also become controversial in the United States, where health authorities have stored leftover blood samples for later medical research, often without parents' knowledge or consent, prompting lawsuits in two states. Now, I'm all for research of DNA with consent. This is completely without consent or knowledge or anything of hospitals effectively stealing without asking the DNA of 800,000 children without the knowledge of the parents knowing it, or now even the children who are now up to 11 years old because they've been doing it since 1999. This is completely outrageous, and this is happening in my own backyard. I live in BC, Canada. I obviously fall outside of the range of 1999 as I'm over the age of 11. But this is incredibly horrible that they are taking people's information without their knowledge and sending it off without any kind of knowledge of the people or any kind of written privacy statement and releasing it to the government without, they ask for it with a warrant and proper court order. But why does it need to be there in the first place? If these are all, they're all babies, they're innocent, they haven't committed any crimes yet that they know of, why does there need to be a huge database ready for culling by the government? Our data does not need to be within the grasp of the government if we've done nothing wrong whatsoever. It's appalling, in fact. And I'm going to let all my friends know about this that have babies so that they can also get involved in getting back their children's information that has been taken without their knowledge. Privacy news from Australia. Not surprising. Travelers to be searched for porn. I should have put this one in the highlights in the top of the show. Sent in by Minded Version. Australian custom officers have been given new powers to search incoming travelers' laptops and mobile phones for pornography, a spokeswoman for the Australian sex industry says. Fiona Patton, president of the Australian Sex Party, is demanding an inquiry into why a new question appears on incoming passenger cards asking people if they're carrying pornography. Patton said officials now have unfettered rights to examine travelers' electronic devices, beginning a new era of official investigation into people's private lives. She questioned whether it's appropriate to search people for legal R18 plus and X18 plus material. Is it fair that customs officers rummage through somebody's luggage and pull out a legal men's magazine or lesbian journal in front of their children or mother-in-law, she said. If you and your partner have filmed or photographed yourselves making love in an exotic destination or even taking a bath, you will have to answer yes to the question and you will be breaking the law. Customs confirmed the new reference to pornography on the incoming passenger cards, and the search powers acknowledged the searches conducted by the officers may involve the discovery of personal or sensitive possessions. A spokesman said officers were trained to apply tact and discretion in their dealings with passengers, including an express reference to pornography is intended to enhance the interception of prohibited pornography at the border by making passengers aware that some forms of pornography may be a prohibited import. That probably was already known before. I'll go on. The pornography question has appeared in the cards since September last year. The change was only spotted by Patton earlier this year and it received little to no coverage in the media. I'd never heard of this before today. Colin Jacobs, chairman of the lobby group Electronic Frontiers Australia, said the change appeared to have sneaked under the radar without any public consultation about massive privacy issues. It's hard to fathom what the pressing concern could be that requires Australia to quiz every entrant to the country on their pornography habits, as if visitors would be aware of the nuances of the Australian classification scheme. If this results in customs trawling through more private information on laptops searching for contraband, I would say the solution is way worse than the problem. Patton said that if the question was designed to stop child pornography being smuggled into the country, then the question should have been asked about child pornography without encompassing regular porn, which is obviously completely legal in the country. So really, what they've done is enacted a law that allows them to search through everybody's bag regardless, which, you know, they can anyway. But it's bringing up the privacy of people's personal possessions, and they have to admit to something that is maybe not morally acceptable among some people, but is completely 100% legal in that country. And that is a big privacy problem. When people have to checkmark on a card, which, you know, they may have to fill out in front of their children saying, yes, I am bringing pornography on the plane with me. And you're filling out this card beside your family, and you're having to hand this card over to the customs agent. And the customs agent is going over saying, right to your face, oh, you have some pornography. I see you've checked that box. Now I'll have to look through your bags for pornography. And it's not something that really is needing to be put on a card. And it gets invasive into something that is already completely legal. And if they're looking for illegal stuff, the illegal stuff is already illegal. Is there going to be a checkbox on the card saying, are you importing anything illegal into the country? People who are importing illegal things are not going to check it off. And people who aren't importing illegal things are going to say no. There's never going to be a time when they're going to put a checkmark for yes on the card. It doesn't make any sense why people have to admit to bringing legal things into the country. This opens the floodgate for them putting on anything on the card that they want that could be embarrassing or morally questionable to a certain population, but completely legal. It's unnecessary. Completely unnecessary. Privacy news from the U.S. Facebook privacy, a bewildering tangle of options. I'm going to go over this quickly. There's enough stuff about Facebook every week. Pop quiz, which is longer? This is sent in by David Gilson. Pop quiz, which is longer, the United States Constitution or Facebook's privacy policy? If you guess the latter, you're right. Facebook's privacy policy is 5,830 words long. The United States Constitution, without any of its amendments, is concise, 4,543. Now, there's a great graphic that goes along with this that you can check out on the page. It outlines how many different options, how many different buttons you have to go through. There's 50 privacy buttons and more than 170 options you have to go through to completely make sure that your Facebook is locked down. I really suggest you go look at this page and follow it up with this next one called Reclaim Privacy, reclaimprivacy.org. This website provides an independent and open tool for scanning your Facebook privacy settings. The source code and its development will always remain open and transparent. You can check out the full code as it checks locally. The script runs only locally to check out your Facebook privacy settings, and it goes through a lot of the Facebook privacy settings, not all of them, but check out that site so you can lock down your Facebook if you do use it. And I know there's a Facebook, quit Facebook on May 31st, if anybody's interested in that as well. In Pirate Party news, yes, everybody's heard it all around the world now. The Swedish Pirate Party is now hosting the Pirate Bay. Sent in by DC, this first person to send it in. Got floods of email about this. After its previous bandwidth provider had to take its site offline due to concerns over an aggressive Hollywood injunction, today the Pirate Bay is fully back in operation with a surprising new supplier. From a few hours ago into a move intended to stand up for freedom of expression, the Swedish Pirate Party became the site's new host. Following an injunction obtained by several major Hollywood movie studios, yesterday Pirate Bay bandwidth provider CB3ROB Limited and Co. KG took the decision to take the site offline while it digested the legal implications. That meant for several hours the Pirate Bay, for the first time in many months, would be taken offline. An insider told Torrent Freak that people shouldn't worry and that the site would soon return. By start of day this morning, the promise had been kept. In most corners of the globe, the world's most resilient BitTorrent tracker was living up to its name by coming back online with a new and yet unnamed host. Today, now the identity of the site's ISP has been revealed, and it's somewhat of a surprising revelation. Today, on 18th of May, the Swedish Pirate Party took over the delivery of bandwidth to the Pirate Bay, said the Pirate Party's Rick Falkvinge in a statement. We got tired of Hollywood's cat and mouse game with the Pirate Bay, so we decided to offer the site bandwidth, he added. It's time to take the bull by the horns and stand up for what we believe is a legitimate activity. The Pirate Party says they will provide bandwidth to the site's homepage and search engine. The Pirate Bay is a search engine and is such not responsible for the results, note noted Falk Vinge. The Pirate Party, adds the attempt at censoring the Pirate Bay is an attempt to silence one of today's most important opinion makers in matters of civil liberties and rights on the web, adding that it is nothing less than a political censorship and something that any democratically minded person must reject. With the general election coming up in Sweden, the Pirate Party's move is also an attempt to reiterate what the Pirate Party stands for. It feels great to get an opportunity like this to demonstrate that we put our money where our mouth is, Falk Vinge told Torrent Freak. We're not your run-of-the-mill politician whose commission's report spends 8 hours a day avoiding blame. We're people committing our own resources and our time to the values we believe in. The only thing we have in common with today's politicians is that you can vote for us. And I hope this demonstrates how we are prepared to take responsibility for civil liberties and the future of the net in a very direct way, he added. Meanwhile, a Pirate Bay insider remains vague about the exact locations of the Pirate Bay servers and assured Torrent Freak that nothing is as it seems. The important thing, though, is that the site is fully functional again. So good on the Pirate Party of Sweden for standing up for what is actually legal in Sweden and not backing down and supporting the Pirate Bay, because I myself have music and video that is indexed by the Pirate Bay that went offline recently because it was taken down by the Pirate Bay. Legitimate media that I am giving out for free that people were not able to access because some people are scared of what media distribution has become in the 21st century. And in free music and media section, The Dangers of ACTA with Lauren Weinstein, sent in by Weird Wolf. He says, the reason I put this here is I wanted to discuss in the audio stream. It's 90 minutes long, but it's a very nice discussion. All the commercials have been pulled, but it's very long. It's put into 10 minutes, and there are 9 sections. I want to warn, there's a longer version that has 16 parts, so it's even longer than this version. It's Ian Purnett hosting Coast to Coast AM with Lauren Weinstein. Lauren Weinstein is an activist concerned with matters involving technology, and this is a discussion on ACTA. He says, I believe it's a tad bit too long, and I wish Ian would have not talked so long. He's not one of the better CNC hosts, but I'm glad to hear him putting this discussion up. And there's also a very good write-up called Why I Steal Movies, Even Ones I'm In, by Peter Serafinowicz, sent in by Mind Inversion. And Peter's an excellent actor. I've seen him in a bunch of stuff. He was in an amazing TV show called, a UK TV show called Spaced, with the actors from Shaun of the Dead. He also provided the voice for the Sith in Star Wars movie, in the first Star Wars movie. Remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local Pirate Party to find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions, or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them through the forum on the website, and it'll send it on to me. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.